From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast, is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Hey y'all, Eve's here. We're doubling up today with two events in history. On with the show. Welcome to This Day in History class. I'm Eve. We'll be continuing our recognition of Women's History Month with another special guest who's coming on to the show today to talk about Lillian Wald. Lillian Wald was born on this day in 1867. She was an American nurse, a social worker, and an author. Our special guest today is Marjorie Field, who teaches history at Babson College. Hi, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. So can you just start off by telling me a little bit about yourself and how you got into Lillian Wald?
Oh, sure. So when I was in college, I was really excited by a historian who taught me my junior year in college. And it was a course, today we would call it gender history, but back then it was called women's history. And I decided that when I was going to do a senior thesis, it was going to cross both of my majors, which by then were Judaic studies, Jewish studies, and U.S. history. So I was looking for a topic with my advisor, who was this marvelous women's history professor, and she recommended this woman named Lillian Wald, whom she knew would cross both Jewish history because she was Jewish at birth, and also would cross U.S. history because she was really invested in U.S. currents of progressive era activism. So I took this on as my senior thesis in college, and then decided that I liked history so much, I wanted to go on to get a doctorate in history. I got into a program in New England and ended up doing a doctoral thesis on Lillian Wald that built on my honors thesis. And then when I got a job, I turned the doctoral dissertation into a book, and that was the book that was published by UNC in 2008. So I've spent many, many years with Wald. I'm generally introduced in forums where I talk about Wald as somebody who spent a lot of time with Wald, and indeed I have.
So can you tell me who was Lillian Wald?
Sure. So she was born in 1867. After the Civil War, and she was born in Ohio, but she always thought of her hometown as Rochester, New York, which is where she was raised. She moved there when she was young. She was the child of immigrants, German Jewish immigrants, who were, you know, relatively Americanized and assimilated, weren't particularly Jewishly affiliated, although her grandparents were, and she was a little bit, which I talk about in the biography. She, very early on in her life, decided that she didn't want to be a society wife like her moms and aunts and even her older sister, And she decided once she saw her sister giving birth that she wanted, she sort of chatted with the nurse who was attending her sister's child's birth, and she decided she wanted to be a nurse. So she ended up going to one of the few careers that was available to women at the time was to become a nurse. So she went to nursing school, and after nursing school, she graduated in 1891. She ended up going to a school where she could have been a doctor. It was one of the few women's medical colleges open at the time. And so this was her first exposure to New York City because she was an upstate person. I don't think it's a mistake that she chose a women's world. She was a lesbian. She was very nurtured and sustained by these women's relationships. While she was there, she was exposed for the first time to the poverty of the Lower East Side, which was then, at the turn of the 20th century, just completely overwhelmed with immigrants who were fueling the industrial growth of the United States, garment trades and other industries. And a lot of, well, she herself, and then since then many others, quote her when they talk about this experience as her baptism of fire, right? So she's young and she's got these nursing skills and she's exposed to the poverty of the Lower East Side for the first time. And basically she decides to settle on the Lower East Side and open what was called a settlement house. First, they offered nursing care to the immigrants, the industrial immigrants of the Lower East Side, and it just expanded. And her work, begun in the 1890s, is now still living. The legacies live on at both the Visiting Nurse Service of New York and Henry Street Settlement, which is still on the Lower East Side. So it was healthcare on a sliding fee scale, often for free for the desperately poor, that then expanded into social work and theater work and all the kinds of things that you still see flourishing at Henry Street, which is turning 125 this year. It's a great place.
Wow.
Yeah. So I say this because her legacy lies in nursing and social work, but also in a sort of like marvelous universalist philosophy that says that everybody, even a relatively wealthy white woman from upstate New York, has a responsibility to help people who are less fortunate and born into less fortunate circumstances. That was her philosophy that guided her nursing and her social work. And she protested war. She fought for women's suffrage. She was a civil rights advocate. She was an immigrant rights advocate. She took the side of labor in many labor disputes. She really tried to apply that philosophy across the board to all these really important 20th century campaigns, you know, that we're still benefiting from in many different ways today.
So what was it about her that made her advocate this hard for so many people? Like, so many people were exposed to poverty and maybe had backgrounds in nursing as well, mm-hmm. but they didn't do the things that Lillian Wall did. So what was it about her that drove her to be the person she was?
Well, you know, when you write a book about somebody, you try to dig deep into their motivations, right? And so my sort of scholarly take on that was that because her family had benefited from a pretty liberal spirit of the times in upstate New York as Jewish immigrants, it was a pretty liberal place. It was the Erie Canal was connected to Rochester. There were abolitionist campaigns in Rochester, women's rights campaigns. That spirit of sort of liberal tolerance and acceptance, I think she carried with her and brought with her to New York. I think also, you know, she was in very much a women's world. It was so attractive to me when I was young to think about all these women trying to find a place for themselves, right, as women, without even having the right to vote. So I think there was a sense that women were responsible for care and nurturing. And so they took that, you know, almost imperative, but certainly that sort of conventional idea out into the public sphere and thought of themselves as needing to care for these immigrants and these, you know, to undo white supremacy. Like they could have that power if society would be willing to give it to them. So they carved out this space for themselves trying to do this work.
Mm-hmm. How did she change the fields of nursing and public health while she was working?
Yeah. So, I mean, when she was involved, she was one of the first Jewish nurses to be a professional, first of all. It was largely Christian nurses. It was also a lot of charity organizations employed nurses. She was very intent on having them separate from any charity work. She wrote early on about the fact that they carried municipal badges, so they were seen as, you know, sort of employees, not technically, but of the city, but having that official status. She really wanted public health to be seen as a right of citizenship for all people. So I think if we think about it today, like the language of today would be, I think, more holistic. Like she thought everybody was entitled to the right, not just to health care, but ultimately she was working, like many women, again, very gendered, for playgrounds in New York City, which didn't exist before she got there, for safe milk, because you would get milk from milk stations at the time before refrigeration was widespread. So I think she professionalized it. She made it obvious, something this country still hasn't learned, that healthcare should be a human right, right? But she also had a very holistic approach to it, to see that it wasn't these people's fault that they were poor, but it was the environment that was leading to, you know, it was deprivation that was to blame for all of the problems, criminality and other kinds of sort of desperate products of the poverty that they were living with day in and day out. So I think she had a sort of a right way of thinking about things, which is to uplift people and to give them their basic rights, and people will make good choices and help others and better society as a whole. It was part of her sort of universalist philosophy, I think.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned earlier a little bit about the legacy, her legacy that lives on in the settlement house. Is there any other way that her work shows up today in nursing or beyond?
That's a good question. I mean, her settlement, I just love Henry Street so much, and they just put up an exhibit for the 125th anniversary that really draws a spotlight on her. So that institution is still in its original home. The staircase that is there, you know, of course, a lot of the longtime employees think it's haunted. So whether she shows up there or not, actually, I think in nursing, in social work, certainly in gendered history, right? I also think as we go back and try to think of LGBTQ heroes, you know, she alerts us to this very sustaining world of women in the early 20th century. I also, you know, with this past election of our 45th president, I was asked to talk about her in quite a few venues, right? To talk about her approach to immigrant rights, which I think is always a lesson, maybe never more urgent than it is right now, at least in my lifetime, because she, the quote I always go back to, she called immigrants new life and new blood for this country, and just talking about the energy that they bring to the United States, and living in a time when that immigrants are demonized and their contributions are erased or made invisible. I think that's a really important lesson that she still offers us too.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that she did or maybe said that may surprise people?
In a good way, you mean?
Oh, either way, good, bad, yeah. Neutral.
Well, I mean, you know, again, when you are doing this research, you try to present all sides of the person.
Mm-hmm.
And she held on to Stalinism into the 1930s, which I don't know if that means a lot to your listeners, but, you know, it was kind of a long time to hold on to the ideal without recognizing the evils that Stalin was doing. And that might be surprising. I think among liberals and leftists in the United States, it wasn't entirely uncommon. But it was when I remember, you know, finding out in graduate school and feeling a sense of disappointment with my hero, but also recognizing, you know, that she was a human and made errors in judgment. I think people are often surprised to learn that she was gay. But again, I think there's so much room for heroes of all kinds in our past that it's a helpful thing to talk about when you talk about her legacy.
Yeah, I think that that's a thing that a lot of people are struggling with right now, recognizing people's whole lives and that people were complicated and trying to deal with all the elements of the things that they believe, their philosophies, and that they did. So what do you want people to take away from Lillian Wall's story overall?
Well, I think, you know, as I say, the lessons about her lessons on immigration and a certain openness and the way we can all benefit from that openness is maybe her most urgent lesson today. But I also would argue that, not argue, but I would point out that here is somebody born to privilege who made these choices based on her conscience, but more than that, right? It wasn't just about her sense like, this is wrong and someone needs to do it and that someone could be me. It was also, she always used this language of mutual responsibility. And, you know, you see this in Gandhi's writings and in Dr. King's writings, this idea that, you know, if one of us isn't free, then none of us are free. And I think Wald brought that into her social work, into her public health work, into her anti-militarism, her work for civil rights and immigrant rights. So I would say that that sense of mutual responsibility is really key to her legacy and also has a certain urgency today. It's easy to shelter ourselves off from the things that are bad in the world and the suffering in the world, but it is our obligation to look hard at it and figure out our own role in undoing some of those evils. I guess that's what I would say.
And when she was working, did she get any pushback from people, from anybody who criticized her or, you know, had strong reactions to the work that she was doing?
Oh, definitely. Yes, of course. She, I mean, again, so I was working with some of the criticisms. I probably didn't engage as much as new scholars will find, but some people thought her work should be more Jewish. There were those who really wanted to claim her for the Jewish world, which she really pushed back against. She was born to a Jewish family, but never really affiliated. So I think the idea that people get to choose their own identities, right, and liberate themselves from the ones that they feel don't fit with their sense of themselves, I think that's important. So the other piece that I ran into, and this is pretty common knowledge, is that when she fought against U.S. Involvement in World War I, she lost funding from some pretty famous people. They really thought that the U.S. was justified in getting involved, but she, interestingly, fascinatingly, understood war to work against the interest of all people. She knew that spending that might well have gone toward public health initiatives was going to be diverted into militarism and weapons and fighting. So she really talked about being anti-war in the vein of being for public health, which is, you know, so radical. I mean, I think we more associate that kind of thinking with Johnson's war on poverty and people understanding that the war on poverty funds were diverted into Vietnam. But here's somebody having that conversation, putting that into the public sphere around World War I, which is pretty radical.
Yeah, it's her story is so interesting because there are so many parallels, and this was a century ago. So Is there anything else that you would like to add? Anything about Lillian Wald or anything that you've been thinking about that came up while we were talking?
I don't think so. I'm really glad we're talking about her because, as you say, I think I teach a course on the 1920s, and a century ago, things were so bad in this country. I mean, lynching and the Red Scare and crackdowns on immigrants, and we're living through an era that is so frightening in terms of the way state power is being used to oppress and marginalize and sanction violence against women, against immigrants, against LGBTQ. So I would say that, you know, she stood for kind of the best of what state power can do, which can connect and enlighten and uplift rather than push down.
Yes, so true.
Yeah.
I'm glad that we got to talk about her today and share her story with everybody because I'm sure there are a lot of people who had no idea about her. So thank you again for coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
If you want to know more about Lillian Wald, you can read Marjorie's book, Lillian Wald, A Biography. You can be on the lookout for more special episodes on Sundays this month to honor women's contributions to history. But until then, see you tomorrow for another nugget from history.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
You ever get that feeling like the concrete jungle's closing in? You crave wide open spaces, the chance to chase your own dinner, or just breathe clean air. Well, listen up. There's a whole world out there waiting, and finding your piece of it just got easier. Head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, you name it. Search by acreage, price, location. They've got it all. No matter what kind of wild dream you're chasing, land.com can help you find the ground to make it a reality. So quit dreaming. Head over to land.com, find your open space, and get out there.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Eves, and you're tuned into This Day in History class, a show that takes history and squeezes it into bite-sized stories. The day was March 10th, 1906. An explosion and fire in a French mine killed 1,099 people, making it one of the deadliest mining disasters in history. The Courrier Colliery was a series of mines near Pas-de-Calais of northern France. More than 2,000 people worked in the mines, and their coal was used mostly in the manufacture of gas. Just days before the explosion, smoke and toxic gas were detected at the site, but the company continued business as usual. Just before 7 a.m. on March 10th, there was a huge explosion. The explosion was likely caused by the ignition of coal dust in the mine, but it's not quite clear what caused that ignition. It could have been caused by the flame of a miner's lamp. It also could have been caused by the mishandling of explosives. Regardless, the fire spread and the explosion caused many deaths and a lot of destruction. Many people died due to asphyxiation or were crushed by falling structures. Others were killed immediately in the blast. Though many people died in the disaster, some escaped and others remained alive in the mines after the initial explosion. State engineers took over operations and efforts began to put out fires, find survivors, and recover bodies. But by the end of the first day, there were still 1,100 people underground. Fires and toxic gases underground got in the way of rescue efforts. The stench of decomposing bodies also posed a health hazard. Experts were sent in from Paris and Germany to help with the rescues. Still, during March, less than 200 bodies were recovered. That said, a group of 13 survivors was found on March 30th, having survived 20 days after the explosion. They had stayed alive by eating horse meat, drinking stagnant water, and resorting to other unappealing but necessary ways to sustain themselves. On April 4th, another miner was discovered alive. He was the last survivor found in the Courrier mines. Newspapers in the area reported on the disaster. Miners across France went on strike in response to the tragedy, and an official survivors fund was established by law. But within the mining communities, people remained upset about the way the rescue was executed. Some people alleged that the state engineers had a vested interest in failing so they could get more work and money from colliery owners. Others believed that rescue efforts were not extensive so the company could save money. Many of the workers who survived were ill or injured in some way, and compensation was not satisfactory. Some of the survivors went back to work in the mines. I'm Eve Jeffcoat, and hopefully you know a little more about history today than you did yesterday. You can find us on social media at TDIHC Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you would like to write me a letter, you can scan it, turn it into a PDF, and send it to us via email at thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll be back tomorrow.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug
all
needed.
Right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota BZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
You ever get that feeling like the concrete jungle's closing in? You crave wide open spaces, the chance to chase your own dinner, or just breathe clean air. Well, listen up. There's a whole world out there waiting, and finding your piece of it just got easier. Head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, you name it. Search by acreage, price, location. They've got it all. No matter what kind of wild dream you're chasing, land.com can help you find the ground to make it a reality. So quit dreaming. Head over to land.com, find your open space, and get out there.